if galvanized tower is only good for 20 or 25 years before it starts showing rust, because that zinc on the outside is always slowly washing away, particularly if you're foolish enough to use non-stainless steel U-bolts. If you use rustable materials in contact with a tower, then the tower and your EMT tubing and your galvanized pipe, all of them will sacrifice their zinc coating to that rusting object, which you believe. Mother Nature's got some funny ways of behaving in that particular area. What have you got any further words you want to give us on this one, Jay, before I go over to Mr. MBK? KC2ZHI, K2RIW, thank you for your info, you're Jay. Okay, so Jay was giving us some more information about getting the delivery of that tubing. And John, I did hear you on the input for reasons I don't understand. I'm not hearing you on the output right now. Let me pick up Mr. MBK first. Oh, no, let me pick up John first. KC2WGB, go right ahead with your comment, John. I'm hearing you on the input, so I'll repeat it if need be. KQRIW.
Aluminum, and you can buy it for scrap value. So that is one way to look into purchase, and you know, all he needs is somebody to give him a ride to the scrapyard. But that's an advantageous place to look. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Well done. So John, just I know John was coming through at the end. I'm not sure if he was coming through in the beginning. So at a scrapyard, you choose the right scrapyard, Rich. Apparently all kinds of steel, aluminum, and whatever kinds of tubing are available at some awfully nice prices. That combined with your friends, once you select a particular diameter of aluminum tubing, for instance, I know for a fact that there are various hams who consider aluminum tubing gold, and they collect it, various lengths, various diameters, various wall thicknesses. You pass out the word you needed, and I'm pretty sure somebody will come forward with that. Mr. MBK, Mike Bravo Kilo is what it sounded like. Please give me your full call and your name, and I proceed with your information. K2RIW in the TechNet, my name is Dick.
Yep, Alpha. You're okay in one of these seats.
Okay, I think I'm hearing my friend from Massapequa. Very weak coming through, but give it another try. You might have to hold that handy talky higher up, sir. Go ahead. Okay, KC2, Mike Delta Papa. I'm hearing you moderately well now. Go right ahead, sir. Steve, go ahead.
Just wanted to throw in my comments. I've been using EMT for years. I've got four homemade towers made out of the stuff. Guy towers ranging from like 30 to 50 feet. And I've been up there for about 15 years or so, and there's really no signs of rust on them. The one tower, the first one I actually did, is I actually took Rust-Oleum paint and painted it. And the paint started to peel off that one, and that one's been up there the longest, probably about 15 years. And underneath the paint, the galvanized looks like it's brand new. So that's my story. Back to you.
Very fine, Steve. I think you said you're coming through with a handy turkey. You must be holding it higher in the air. You found a good spot. You came through full 100%. Okay, so your EMT tubing, with 15 years, no significant rust, and you can always paint it with a cold galvanized paint, and there's other ways of better preparing the surface, so you can get even better preparation on the paint. I've been talking to, there's a guy in southern New Jersey who does painting of towers as a profession, one of many things he does, and he's been recommending to me what brand of paint and what brand of preparation you do to a tower ahead of time to make sure the paint really sticks correctly. There's a whole art and science to putting paint on top of zinc, brand new zinc. And you can take your Rust-Oleum can of paint and spray it onto the zinc, and at first it looks hunky-dory, but zinc, brand new what I'm saying is brand new zinc has got some peculiar characteristics where of the zinc, I think life is a little bit easier. But it's something to worry about. There's a whole art and science to getting paint onto a galvanized material, particularly this real fresh hot dip galvanized zinc in there. Okay, good luck with that project, Rich. And think about the fact that no matter how many antennas you got up, you're going to want more of them in the future. So plan ahead. Don't do one of the things that I did, for instance, as I added antennas to my tower. I didn't insist that everybody adding an antenna to my tower, mostly me, of course, didn't do a real good job of labeling every single wire that comes down. You've heard that story of how my unlabeled wires got me into trouble recently. So we got to think ahead. John, I think it's time to go over to the mailbag, KC2WGB. I hope you do get a chance to tell Caroline that that was one hell of a question she asked, and we're not going to hear the end of that one for a couple of weeks. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Dick, I also have an additional comment, if I may, on Richie's poll question.
You're allowed to talk anything you want. We don't run strict protocol here, John. There's a small fee involved. Go ahead, John.
Okay, so maybe the time is up.
Chat, chat.
I want to try repeating that message, John. KC2WGB, K2IW.
Yes, Dick, as far as Richie's question for Matt. They're usually necked down at one.
Stick your head in the fish. Stick your head in the fish.
Okay, we heard that it's necked down at one end. All right, give us the rest of the information, John, go ahead. Antenna that would have failed at a 30 mile an hour wind will literally tolerate 130 mile an hour wind if you've done a good guiding job. So that there's the screw eyes that go into the rafters of the house that pick up the guy wire, as long as that they're well attached. And maybe it'll require a real good bolt and sandwiching of boards behind the rafters inside the roof in order to do that. But you do a good job of putting up guy wires, and you can literally make all kinds of crazy antennas on the chimney of your house survive 130 mile an hour wind without creating stress on the chimney. You'd be amazed how many guys will put a station master antenna, a great big tall 15 foot long thing on the chimney of the house. A great big wind comes along, and all of a sudden the chimney breaks off and falls to the ground. There's nothing stopping you from putting guy wire, literally, on your station master antenna. I have done that. You have to be a little bit smart as to where you put it. But you can take something like a station master antenna on the chimney of a house, and you guide it in such a way the chimney will never see any bending moment as long as the guy wire doesn't break. That's another whole technique you should tuck into your pocket, if you know what I mean. KC2WJB, KQRIW, the TechNet. You got it, John.
Who are you?
And if Bernie is around, could he give me a phone call?
Okay, so you'd like a phone call from Bernie, and let's see, should I be sending anybody a message? I don't think so. Okay, Rich, I know you had a further comment. N2EO, K2RIW, you've got a lot of combinations for your tubing here, Rich. Go ahead, you got it, Rich.
Maybe that's what I'll do. What do they call them? A swag end? And you can put two pieces together. Maybe it'd be best to drill a hole through it, run a bolt through it. I don't know. Like I say, the only reason I'm being so particular is I gotta depend on other people with the situation here. And I'm not gonna be putting up a lot of antennas because my girl in the house does not like, for whatever reason, she does not like ham radio. So, I have to keep peace in the house. Do you think, in your opinion, to get on repeaters, mainly this repeater and a 440 repeater in Queens, or have any trouble with the disc on? Last week, you seemed to feel it would work all right.
Until you run the experiment, there's no guarantees, Rich. Most of Massapequa is fairly flat land, and it should have pretty good line of sight to the repeaters you want. Therefore, the disc cone should do it. When in doubt, though, antennas that have got some altitude and gain, I know you don't want to put up a whole lot of altitude, but altitude and gain is going to help. Disc cone's a good beginning. I'm just not convinced that you're going to be thoroughly happy with it forever. I think you're going to eventually be mounting other antennas somewhere. And even if the tubing swage is the word you're looking for, when you've got pieces of tubing that taper at one end and one plugs into another, and you ram them together with a hammer, I think they call that swaging. And there's various ways that you can increase the strength of that joint, hose clamps and a sistered piece of tubing on the outside across the joint with or without bolts going through. There's all kinds of ways you can make it stronger. But the real thing you got to worry about is that at the top of the mast, what is the real wind load of that antenna? How many foot-pounds of bending moment is it going to apply to the straps on the chimney? And can the chimney take it? When in doubt, put guy wires. And the guy wires, if somebody's afraid that they're going to be much too obtrusive, optically speaking, you can paint them any color you want so that they almost disappear, if you know what I mean. You don't want shiny new brand flashy guy wire on there because somebody's going to look at your chimney and say that looks homely. The majority of people never look up in the air. You can always prove that to yourself by taking all the people that ever visit you and ask them, what's the color of the shingles on my house? And 90% of the time, they ain't going to be able to give you an answer. People don't look up in the air. Stop worrying. A person who knows that something new has been installed, then they go to look for it. If you run a survey about a company that wants, you run a survey about a company that wants to put a new cell site into a particular town, and everybody starts talking about the unsightliness and the change in property values and the radio frequency biohazard and all this jazz. And yet every 150 feet down the street, you got a great big ugly utility pole. They've been there for zillions of years. Your drive to work in the morning, you probably pass 300 of those, and I bet you've never even seen one of them. You've learned to ignore them because they've always been there. But if somebody puts up a brand new shiny utility pole, everybody will notice it. Somebody puts up a brand new cell site, everybody will notice it. Somebody proposes to put some offshore windmill power generating things 4 miles south of Long Island, Fire Island, where you have to look with binoculars to see it, and people are complaining that you're going to be cluttering up my beautiful view of the ocean. Come on. People resist change. So just make it as unobtrusive as you can, but don't be afraid to use guy wires. You'll gain tremendous strength and wind-loading characteristics when you do that, Rich. N2EO for any other comments? K2LIW in the Tech Man.
Hey, Dick. Well, the chimney is in one corner of the house, so I really can't... if the chimney was, like, in the middle, I'd be able to guide it, but it's in one corner, and I have to guide it to the backyard, so I can't do that. But, all right, look, I don't think a discount is going to create enough wind drag. One of the guys in this club has mounted a high-gain DX88 on a chimney. That's a 40, 10 meter vertical. And that put a lot of stress. He had the chimney come down, but I don't think that's going to happen in my case with this. Anyway, we'll see how it works out, how it plays out. Dick, like I said, the whole problem is I can't do this myself. I have to depend on other people. I've got this fellow in Baldwin. He's not familiar at all with him. Antennas, but he seems like a nice guy, and he's willing to work with me.
Well, your chimney is on one side of the house. That may not be the ideal place to put the antenna, Rich. If it's a really small antenna, and you've got reason to believe your chimney is super strong, yes, you can go that way. But a hell of a lot of guys eventually put a TP mount, one of these small little tripod-like things, probably mounted to the center of the roof near the ridge line of the roof, near the top of the roof, if you know what I mean. And I think you can get a lot better performance out of various antennas in that location. And if somebody's worried about the unsightliness of that, don't hesitate to paint it. Whatever color can make it almost disappear, if you know what I mean. You don't want shiny new flashy galvanizing when you first put that up, because people recognize change. You want to minimize the change they're going to see. Therefore, make sure you paint it some very unobtrusive dark color, if you know what I mean, before putting it on the house. That's my recommendation. And so, I bet you've done a fair amount of painting of things that you want to put up in the air. Is that true, Rich? I mean, John, KC2WGB, K2RIW in the Tech Net. Steve, MDP, go right ahead.
So I have a 5 foot tripod that I am not using. It's in great shape, and the nice thing is it's been weathered, so the galvanized is a little tarnished. If Rich wants it, he's more than welcome to it. I can drop it off. I'm involved in myself, so even if he needs some help with this antenna, I'll be more than willing to help him out.
I kind of thought so. Well done, Steve. That's an attractive offer. And where it's a little bit weather, that means it's even easier to make the paint stick to it when he paints it, whatever color he's going to paint it before putting it up. So, I presume you're easy to get a hold of. You're listed in QSZ.com. You're in the phone book. If Rich wants to get a hold of you to close the deal, Steve, what's your recommendation as to how he should do it? KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, he can email me. It's mycall@optonline.com. I have an account through AERRL, but it doesn't seem to work all the time. It's unreliable. So it's mycall, KC2, Mike Delta Papa, at optonline.net.
Okay, JC2, MDP, at optonline.net. Well done. Alrighty. That's an attractive offer. And thank you. KC2 WGB, K2RIW, you got it, John.
KC2 WGB, sorry for the long delay, Dick. Had to take care of something. By the way, anytime you're dealing with VIN-coded products, and again, if you use vinegar, and a generous amount of vinegar, a couple of coats, kill it. Especially if it's an over or something like that, it will stick. I've done that, and yes, I've done a lot of painting. On that type of stuff, they don't worry about it.
It sounds like you felt like you were away for a while. We were in conversation, so we didn't even miss you, John. We didn't even know you were away. You shouldn't have told us. You got a check.
Well, that's all right. I had cookies in your headphones that I was covering. Okay. I had a question from a gentleman who's trying to understand a conversation. And you were explaining the phone system. Are working with single sideband with multiple transmissions on a pair of wires. Say to him, how that's done means multiplexing, how that is used. And he wonders, even though it's sideband, how do you put multiple compositions on two wires and be able to separate a quick rundown on that?
You've got a nice strong carrier, beautiful sounding audio, but you could use 3 decibels more audio, John. You're speaking kind of softly today. By comparison to my voice. You sound good, but you could be a little bit louder. The majority of the multiplexing that was done with single sideband with telephone circuits, the majority of that took place over their microwave links. Back in the day when you and I were first cutting our teeth in electronics, John, oh, let me pick a number, 1950s, 1960s, even into the 1970s, as you drove across the real estate, Long Island, New Jersey, Connecticut, whatever. You saw a whole bunch of these towers. Each tower was around 150 foot high, and you saw a hardcore antenna on the side of the tower near the top. And these, every 30 miles, you had all kinds of microwave linking. That was the Bob Bell telephone system. And on that microwave linking at 2.4 gigahertz in those days, you had master group, super group, they had all these words that were used for one pilot tone with a whole bunch of subcarriers. Every subcarrier was probably 5 kilohertz apart, and in some cases there were hundreds of these individual subcarriers on the main carrier. Each individual subcarrier had a single sideband signal that was the audio of that particular telephone conversation. So in the microwave links that took place, when it comes to the twisted pair, I don't think that took place very much, if at all. Yes, you could if you want to. Let me drop. Twisted pair wire. A couple of miles of it will transmit audio and the DC voltage that operates the telephone rather nicely. In some cases, the twisted pair wire will also carry a higher frequency signal. I'm going to pick a number out of the air. 50 kilohertz, 150 kilohertz, 1 megacycle, 3 megacycles. You could put various frequencies simultaneously down the twisted pair wire. The twisted pair, you think, is set up for audio. It's simultaneously a parallel transmission line. I'm not sure of the exact impedance. It may be something in the vicinity of 100 ohms. In fact, the Cat 5 cable that we pull through all of our overhang ceilings, our hung ceilings in the commercial buildings for all of your computer networking, the cadmium 5 or Cat 5, they call it cable, Cat 6, they are twisted pair, and I think they are very close to 100 ohm impedance. And each Cat 5 cable has got 4 individual twisted pairs, a total of 8 wires. I personally have sent 900 megacycle signal down those twisted pairs, and you can go a considerable distance, at least 500 feet or 1,000 feet, and get plenty of signal with good isolation between them, because the 4 wires have 4 different twist rates, so they don't even couple. In other words, you got 4 twisted pairs in each Cat 5 cable. Let me drop. I heard somebody say comment. I'll pick you up in a minute. can, all right, go ahead and come in person, because maybe you already got the information I'm going to say. That'll be the call letters, your name, and then continue with your comments, sir. K2LAW and the tech man.
I just wanted to let you know that two Cat 5 and Cat 6 are put the entire broadcast spectrum on a distributed bandwidth. And the main thing you need to do is put many videos, still videos. A lot of the main things you can do, sorry, don't you need to do.
Very nice carrier, but your audio is 10 decibels low. So I repeat what he said. And what he said is he sent his hold audio broadcast transmitting signal, television signal, over a Cat 5 or a Cat 6 cable. Out of curiosity, how long was that particular cable? And were you using the four separate twisted pairs in some kind of a frequency combination? Or was all of that information going over one of those twisted pairs? Give us a lot more audio, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW Mobile, K2LAW TechNet.
Actually, the entire broadband spectrum, you know, from like, what is it, from 50 megahertz to about 800, yeah, I think it cuts off at about 800, you're in essence using two pairs, but it can also be done, and there's also devices out there with four pairs. Ones that I was using use four pairs, so. I don't think it splits it up. I'm actually not sure how it works. I've not looked at it schematically, taken it apart, but here's the box.
Okay, so you're in your business, they send the whole video signal, high definition television signal, through a Cat 5 or a Cat 6 cable. Roughly what length of cable have they done that successfully with Eric? And I'm pretty sure you've got to be careful with the terminating of the ends to make sure you're not getting triple transit and getting ghosting. Although maybe with digital television, that's no longer a problem. So did you do that for 1,000 feet or a mile? Roughly how much distance did you transmit that signal from Cat 5 cable? KE2EJ, now your radio sounds good. K2LAW.
All right, K2LAW, K2J. You can run, right, first of all, let me qualify. The high definition video, of course, is MPEG. And it's data, just like data is. So, you know, you can run it through the traditional length of Cat 5 cable, which is 300 meters. That's the limit, even when you're using it as a plain old base cable. But, believe it or not, the television station gets its feed from Syracuse. And Syracuse sends it down as data. You know, just straight old IP data. Of course, the captions, all is an HSD stream, so an MPEG, a pure MPEG stream. But it gets all the way from Syracuse to Plainview to get transmitted. And it runs through Cat 5, actually Cat 6 cable, of course. So, the broadcast industry, including the audio industry, is quickly moving to Cat 6 as the method of moving both audio and video.
Now, I believe that your signal coming from Syracuse all the way down to Long Island probably came down in fiber optic after the fiber optic converter converted it back to analog or digital audio. Then you shipped it around the building with Cat 5, Cat 6, is my guess. I'm having a little trouble believing. If I took your words literally, and I shouldn't, it sounded like you were saying that Cat 5 or Cat 6 transmitted the signal all the way from Syracuse down to Long Island. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
No, as I said, there's a physical limitation to what you can use on Cat 5 or Cat 6 cable. The maximum recommended length is 300 meters because after that the capacitance gets so bad that they can't figure out what's an edge and what's around it. No, you can't feed it that far like that. Yes, it comes down via fiber optic. But the entire plant, the terminal devices, even today the video cameras have, you know, RJ45 sockets for an RJ45 mail connector, which has Ethernet cable on it. And you can run that up to 300 meters, but you
amplify it. And they make it pretty easy to do that. Today, it's even easier to P-divide it.
So the bottom line of all this is that when you look with your eye at twisted pair wiring, at first it looks like it's very poorly shielded. You would think it would radiate like crazy. Properly done with full differential transmitter and receivers on digital circuitry or RF circuitry, twisted pair can be an extremely good transmission line. But now I think a little bit more explanation is required for what we mean by subcarriers. Assume I've got a microphone circuit going into a transmitter. The transmitter could be an AM transmitter, could be an FM transmitter. But assume that my microphone circuit is a very broadband one, so that at first my audio from the microphone is going into that circuit and goes out of the transmitter, no problem. I've got another circuitry off to one side, which creating a tone of, let me pick a number, 20 kilohertz. Another tone at 40 kilohertz. Another tone at 60 kilohertz. 80 kilohertz and 100 kilohertz. So I'm transmitting all of these tones, ultrasonic tones, down the microphone circuit, going into the transmitter, simultaneous with my audio. If I do it correctly, my audio will still come through hi-fi. If the receiver and the transmitter are properly designed, those other subcarriers, I'm calling them, those other tones are going through simultaneously. Now, if each one of those tones at 20 kilohertz and the tone at 40 kilohertz, if I have now separate FM or separate amplitude modulation of that tone, then all of those tones are going through simultaneously with completely separate pieces of information. A properly designed receiver will hear each one of those individual signals independently of everything else. That's the so-called subcarrier technique. NASA used that. Let me drop. The command service module on Apollo 15 and 16, which I listened to, the main astronaut audio was on 1.25 megacycles of subcarrier on the main carrier. So they generated a separate tone at 1.25 megacycles and put astronaut audio on that tone and then combined that into the FM or phase modulated transmitter that transmitted the main carrier. And 1.25 megs was audio, 1.024 megacycles was telemetry data, battery voltages and accelerations and pressures and temperatures and whatever. A whole bunch of individual pieces of information were on a separate subcarrier. So the whole idea of putting multiplexed frequency domain or time domain, but mostly frequency domain, I'm describing, multiplexing by generating separate tones which become a carrier, even though they're called subcarrier, because they're putting onto the main signal, still they call them subcarriers, and you can have separate modulation in all of those. You can do this on wire. And is Ma Bell doing it there? I'm not sure. But I know that the hardware will let them do it if they wanted to. Maybe that's some of the answer this person's looking for, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, hope the audio's a little better, Dick. Okay, I think basically he has his answer, and it really applies more to the microwave transmission than within the cable itself, as far as we know right now. But that would be an interesting thing to find out also. I know it can be done, but whether they do it, that I don't know. Okay, let me let it drop on more to the next one.
Yeah, there's one more thing I should add here. I'm guessing that although it's an older technique, that it still is being used today. If you Google the word earring, I-R-I-G, India Romeo India Golf, I-R-I-G, that was a whole standard for subcarriers, for telemetry data, which was very popular in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So there were many telephone circuits, for instance, that had these other subcarriers. Earring subcarriers were very low frequencies by modern day techniques. Some of those earring subcarriers were, 5 KC's, 6 KC, 8 KC, numbers like that. They were very specific frequencies, and each one of those individual tones, so to speak, was considered a separate carrier, all combined under one pair of wires, so to speak. And each one of them had separate modulated information, like battery voltages and temperatures and so on. So the earring subcarrier. area technique. I'm transmitting data was very popular, very well established standard that was used in the old days. And I'm guessing that if we Google those words today, we'll get a lot of information on that subject. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Call the still fat equipment.
Give us a couple of words on that. You built earring equipment. Start off by telling me what earring stands for and tell us what you built. In fact, you were doing that with Bob Bill, weren't you, Vito? Go right ahead, Vito.
I said K2GJE, Cardian built that equipment for the New York City subway system.
Okay, give us a few more words on that one, Ed. By the way, your voice sounds a little bit similar to Vito, and that's how I got confused. So the subway system, I think you're telling me you used earring subcarriers on the signaling system. I know that both the Long Island Railroad and the Metropolitan Transportation Authority with their subways, I am guessing they have all used signaling sent down the tracks, down the third line, the third, can we call it the third rail? Yes, the third rail. The signaling, I'm guessing, was done by earring, and you worked with some of this. Is that true, Ed? Give us a few words on this. K2GJE, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Cardia built equipment for the New York City subway was to install the public address systems at the stations. They did not have enough pairs in the telephone cable. I was measuring frequency response on cable, and they used only one pair to hit many stations. Over.
The one pair hit many stations, so I guess you're saying that a general announcement at many stations simultaneously was done that way, or maybe separate tones were sent down there so that only one station in a line carried the audio. It's a bunch of guesses on my part. Make sure you wait for the three beeps before you pick up, Ed. K2GJE, K2RIW in the TechNet.
They had different tones for different stations, and they were able to make the announcement in Manhattan all the way from Brooklyn over.
And now, that signal from Manhattan all the way into Brooklyn, giving an announcement on that particular station, was that sent down the third rail? What was the communication path by which that signaling and that audio, or that PA system audio, took place? How was the signal sent down there? I think you're telling me it was twisted pair wire. K2GJE, K2RIW.
It was twisted pair wire in the telephone cable, and they had all different size cables, 250 pair, 100 pair, 50 pair, but they used that for many different purposes, and they did not have enough pairs to go all over the system, so they designated one pair with different frequencies to hit different stations or groups of stations. Over.
Well done. My mind's going blank. I forgot the name of these great big fat cables that Bob Bell has been using for years, which each one carries a megabit or 12 megabits of data. What's the name of those great big cables? Nobody else knows the name of them either. It's a very popular name. You'd recognize it immediately. A whole bunch of twisted pair of cables and a great big bundle that Bob Bell has used for years. It's got a very specific name. All of a sudden, I can't think of that name. It'll come to us. Over to you, John. But the word subcarrier and individual pieces of information, it's amazing how many simultaneous pieces of information you can put on one piece of wire, one pair of wires, if you're smart enough to use individual higher frequency tones for the individual pieces of frequency, individual pieces of information. And those are called subcarriers when it's done on a master carrier. Or it can be done by individual tones, call them individual carriers if you like. But twisted pair wire, used correctly, has a hell of a lot higher frequency response and a hell of a lot more distance than first becomes obvious. And it's a lot better shielded than first becomes obvious. As long as your transmitter is doing pure differential mode transmitting and your receiver is doing pure differential mode receiving between the two wires, you'd be amazed how well that pickup, interference. You'd be amazed how well shielded that is, as long as you use the, as long as you terminate the two ends and use them correctly with transmitters and receivers on the ends of those twisted pair of wires. It's a, there's a lot more technology there than first meets the eye, even though it's a, it's deceptively simple. KC2WGB, K2LAW, the TechNet.
Comment, AC2IS.
Okay, Bill, AC2IS. One of these days we gotta, we gotta give you a better antenna on your, on your chimney there, Bill. Go right ahead, Bill.
Just wanted to mention that T1 carries 1.5 megabits, but it's only a few pairs of wire, so it does not sound like what you were talking about. AC2IS.
Yeah, T1 is what I was thinking of. I guess I've never seen a T1. I assume that has a whole bunch of individual twisted pairs. You're telling me that there's very few twisted pairs. All right, you apparently seen a T1 cable. If I chopped off a T1 cable and looked at the end of it, tell me what I would see, Bill. AC2IS, K2RIW.
AC2IS here, depends on where you cut. If you're cutting in the middle of a phone line, you know, phone cable could be a 50 pair cable, and T1 might just be two or maybe four, I forget, pairs on that cable. AC2IS.
Okay, two or four pairs. Let's assume it was four pairs. Would it have physical appearance at all similar to a Cat5 cable? A Cat5 cable is four pairs with four different twist rates. Is it possible a T1 cable, done with a little bit more integrity, a little bit more high fidelity, but it really could be two or four pairs with two or four different twist rates, with maybe a nice shield around the whole thing? So is there, circuit-wise, some similarity between Cat5 and T1? AC2IS, K2LAW.
AC2IS here, T1 will traverse a Cat5 of 1.5 megabits, and the lowest speed of the Cat5 cable is 10 megabits, so T1 is much slower. There are also standards for T3 and other higher speeds. I think if T3 is 45 megabits, again, slower than 100 megabit connection. T1 and I believe T3 will traverse Cat3 cable. AC2IS.
Okay, now let's talk about a T1. Although the data rate is a little bit slower, 1.5 megabits on a T1, what's the maximum length that a T1 can have? I'm going to guess something like 4 miles. AC2IS, K2RIW.
I don't have that information, but it would be at least miles. Back in the day, a T1 would traverse all the way from a CO to the end of that, you know, coverage district for a CO, so whatever distance that would be, same kind of distance, max distance for a phone line, I expect. AC2IS.
Very fine. I'm amazed that when I listen to you on 375, you are very quiet, yet when I listen to you on 85, apparently the link between 375 and 85 is a little bit noisy. So some of the noise I'm hearing is not you, it's the linking. And so that's one of the many things that's being worked on with this system. So, simple looking wire, twisted pair wires, multiple twisted pair wires in a bundle, has a lot more signaling capability than first meets the eye, as I see it, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Come a long way. We really have twisted pair and just common copper stuff. All the stuff we've got going today, communications, has just gotten very complicated. Very good. Alright, I'm going to drop the button. Thank
you. Once again, your audio has dropped down, Rich. John, I think you're stepping away from the mic. You got to eat the mic a little bit. Go ahead, John.
You're right, Dick. I got to run this thing straight in front of the mic instead of on this side. Okay. Have a gentleman here with a radio unknown amplifier, and he has gone through a real miserable troubleshooting. What a problem. It's a tube amplifier. And long story short, it had a hum, and he went through all the filters, tracing the hum down. He found out when cut the wires on the transformer, the power transformer, that fed the 12-volt filament circuit, which feeds the 12AX and 12AT7, up, again, long story short, he put a DC supply, supplying 12 volts on the filament. The hump went away. He has traced all the capacitors, all the connections on the 12 volt AC. Cannot find out where that hump is coming from. Suggestions for anything he can do. Back to you, KC2WGP.
Yeah, my goodness, is that a tough one? Huh. In some cases, the really high-fidelity audio, high-fidelity radios would have either 6 volts or 12 volts for the filament wiring, and sometimes that transformer had a center-tap lead on the filament wiring, which was grounded, so that now the right side and the left side of the filament lead of each individual tube had opposite voltage, if you know what I mean. 3 1/2 volts on each side, 6.3 volts between the two, or 12 volts between the two. Because many tubes do have a little bit of coupling between the filament wiring that's inside the cathode, that's inside the vacuum tube, and the cathode itself. There is some capacitive coupling there, which can couple a signal through. That's a tough one. What I would have done in his case is I would have opened up the lead between the AM detector output and the audio input, probably is right at the volume control. I would take a known good signal generator and inject audio signal into the volume control after disconnecting the rest of the radio circuit between that and the antenna. I'm doing a divide and conquer. Is the hump coming from all the RF and IF and local oscillator circuits? Is that where the hum is coming from? Or is it coming from the audio amplifier chain? There's usually about 2 tubes between the volume control and the final speaker output. So by dividing the two and putting in a known good clean audio there, and find out, does it come through with hum or without hum? Now you know schematic repeater.
Time out.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
I have worked on a lot of 2x5 stuff over the years. I've run into a situation almost like that. It turned out to be tube stopping. So as it had aged, it became slightly conductive in little places. And picked up some of the AC from solar. Kind of did the amplifier in to just usability, the high quality amplifier.
How about that? So if the amplifier had been put into a poor condition, in other words, it was stored in the basement and water got in there, or moisture got in there, and that the tube socket itself became conductive between certain terminals, that could certainly do it. Again, this divide and conquer that I'm recommending by putting in, open up the lead from the rest of the detector circuit of the radio and plug in a good clean audio signal generator to the volume control and find out if hum is coming through that way. Again, you've got to find out which tube socket is it. Is it one on the right-hand side of the schematic or the left-hand side? So I can remember the days of my troubleshooting when I was doing radio and television repair, putting my finger on the volume control and just seeing the hum that comes through would tell me whether or not the audio circuit was alive when I'm not hearing any audio, and was it something else? There's a whole bunch of signal injecting techniques, divide and conquer techniques, that can help you pin this down. I mean, the last thing you'd want to do, the last thing you'd want to do is replace every one of the tube sockets one at a time to try to find the bad one. By various signal injecting techniques, you can start zeroing down to the main offending circuit, assuming there was only one. In most cases, when you get a failure, when the radio used to work well, there's only one failure. So, divide and conquer, signal injecting, signal sampling. There's ways that you can sample the signal that's in the IF strip and plug it into the right kind of instrumentation and find out if the signal is clean at that point. And you can slowly work your way toward the antenna. And again, you can use the right kind of a signal generator to generate a signal with amplitude modulation that you plug into the IF strip and see if it comes out clean without hum. So by way of signal testing, signal sampling, signal injecting, I think you're going to get the quickest answer. Another crazy thing that can do it is and therefore some of the high voltage is being creating a current into the grid of the next tube and changing the bias on the tube. By way of a good vacuum tube voltmeter measuring voltages, let me drop it. Measuring those voltages on the control grid, that could give you a clue. There's lots and lots of ways of doing troubleshooting in this case, even though it's a very difficult case, I know. So, as the person follows through with some of these testing procedures, John, hopefully he'll write back to you and tell us what he found. As you can tell, Eric gave us one of the very wild cases. I can remember a very wild case I had that drove me crazy with a television set, which would play beautifully for 20 minutes, and then it would stop. And by signal injecting techniques, I found out that one of the intermediate frequency IF cans, one of the shielded structures, rectangular shielded structure, which has got a primary and a secondary coil tuned to the IF frequency, 41 megacycles, in the case of a television set, periodically when the television heated up, one of those coils became an open circuit. And every time the set cooled off, the circuit would go back to normal operation. And so, without signal injecting techniques, that would have been crazy. That one did drive me crazy for most of a week. That was one of the toughest cases I ever had when I was doing TV repair, working my way through college. I bet you've had a few of those, John. KC2WGB, K2IIW.
KC2WGB. Oh, absolutely right, Dick. Yeah, we can really get some mystery. My recommendation is what I would try. Eric brought up a very good point. I would wind up disabling the filament on each individual 12-volt tube and supplying that tube with 12 volts DC. Turn it back on. If thumb is gone, isolated it in either that socket or that particular area. Until he finds the tube, there's only 5 to 12-volt tubes in there, so it shouldn't take him too long. But it's going to be a major effort. I don't think it's anything to do with the transformer, as he suggested. Look into L transformers, tell them 12 volts AC, try to replace that, and that could prove the transformer. I don't think that's anything to do with the transformer, measuring 12 volts AC on it, and no leakage. So, and it's not a sensor tap winding, this is an omission. But, okay, good, let me drop, and I'll go on to the next one. Okay, this young gentleman, maybe Paul can help us out with this. It's about the Hubble telescope. He wants to know if it's definitely a dead issue where they will not repair it any longer. He says it's a very valuable instrument. I'd like to know, is there a chance that it could be maintained further or improved? I know it's going to be, it's not really going to be replaced. There's going to be additional new ones put up there, but it's still a useful item. So he has a lot of questions about that. I'd like to know your opinions. And Paul, maybe you can help him on that because he thinks it's a very valuable asset. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB. Then we can go to Paul.
We're about to go to Paul for two separate reasons. Yeah, James Webb is going to be a major replacement for some of the wavelength range of Hubble. I believe there's also a couple of European satellite telescopes that are about to be launched in the coming years. No matter how many telescopes we've got in space, no matter how many telescopes we've got on the ground, no matter how many radio telescopes we've got in the ground or on the air, it's never enough. We're always building bigger and better ones. Each time you build a bigger and better one, you find more and more stuff and more things you've never expected. This universe is very complicated. You can quote me on that. My goodness, is that a euphemistic understatement, if you know what I mean. Whenever you put a gamma ray detector in space, no matter how big you make the gamma ray detector, no matter how much dynamic range you give it, it's just a matter of time before Mother Nature creates a blast somewhere in space that saturates your detector. And you can't even measure how strong the blast was because you pegged the needle, if you know what I mean. So, there's some wild stuff going on out there. I know that Hubble arguably is, Hubble is the most productive piece of electronics that NASA ever produced. If you ask any man in the street what's the best thing NASA has ever done, you probably would first get an answer. Neil Armstrong landing on the moon, followed real fast by the Hubble Space Telescope. I think those are the biggest things that the American public can really recognize. And from time to time we talk about establishing robot-like devices that will be unmanned and capable of visiting the things that are in near Earth orbit, low Earth orbit, and they're dreaming about the day when they'll be able to send a robot out there to geosynchronous orbit and do repairs and refurbishing and refilling up the fuel tanks, if you know what I mean. It's just a matter of time, because remotely operated vehicles, Curiosity, and all the others that are on Mars, like, can I think of the name of them right now? Spirit, Opportunity, Curiosity, and all the things that are in orbit around Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and so on. These remotely operated spacecraft, unmanned spacecraft, are doing more and more elaborate things. It's just a matter of time before NASA, let me drop it, invents one that's going to be doing all these repairs. And so, will Hubble ever be repaired again? I would put my money on yes. However, when? Is it going to happen next year? No way. Is it going to happen in the next 10 years? I give you a 50-50 chance. Will Hubble ever be thoroughly abandoned? I think not. I hope that Paul's got some more words on this. WS2N. Boy, are we ready for the space report, Paul? K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Paul.
WS2N. I know we've talked about this problem in past nets with the Hubble. And over the years since it was launched, 1995 servicing missions, and the last one was brought it really up to date the best they could. Made sure all four gyros were working, they replaced one or two. Solar panels, new batteries. Thing is really running very, very good right now. There's a predicted usage right now to 2018-2019. Coincidentally, that brings you up to the James Webb Space Telescope. They'd like to use the two at the same time and even point them at the same location, which would be terrific in 2018 and 2019. And they think that might be possible. I think they can get another 6-7 years out of Hubble, but they start to fail. On the last mission, what they did...
Paul, you sound good, but you could use 2 dB more audio. Go ahead.
Okay, I can just turn it a little bit here and there. I don't know. It's about it. Must be conditions there. Otherwise, I have to go the other way, and you know what's happening there. The last guy was... a couple of guys ago was pretty weak. So we'll try this fanatic. Move the beam a little bit. Any better?
I'm not asking you to move the beam. I'm not talking about your carrier strength. I'm talking about the amount of audio modulation. Please move the beam back where it was. It was beautiful. And just speak a little louder into the mic. Over you, Paul.
Okay, there we go. Very good. There we go. We're back. The last mission... after installing gyroscopes, batteries, bringing everything up to date. I think two gyros were down the last time they went up. Was that 2009, I think, was the last mission. They attached a berthing-type mechanism to the bottom of the telescope. And the two reasons. The main reason is eventually this thing might fail. And if it gets to the point where it starts going erratic, gyros out, one gyro left, they will have to send a spacecraft up. Even the Falcon 9 will have that capability. They might employ SpaceX to do it, to send a...